This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from Peter Kovacs, the editor of The Advocate. He'll comment on 5 years of the new ownership of the state's largest newspaper. Businessman John Georges began his reign as Advocate owner on May 1st, 2013, and one of his first moves was to hire Peter Kovacs, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who spent many years with the Picayune, as his editor. And we'll talk with Peter about the state of newspapers in the country and in Louisiana. Also, author Elizabeth Partridge discusses her book, Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam. In over a decade of bitter fighting, the war claimed the lives of more than 58,000 American soldiers and beleaguered four U.S. presidents. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Bonchon is producing today, and your numbers are 877-217-5757. And in Baton Rouge, you can call 297-5633. Send us an email if you wish at talk@talklouisiana.org. And we begin with Peter Kovacs. He's the editor of The Advocate, the largest newspaper, now the newspaper of record in Louisiana. 7 days a week is The Advocate, and Peter's former employer, the Picayune, as we know, is down to 3 days a week of printed material, and The Advocate has kind of taken hold as the newspaper, the go-to newspaper, to find out what's happening each and every day in our state, and serves readers from Lafayette to New Orleans. Dates back 176 years, and it was 5 years ago today that John Georges took the reins as the owner of The Advocate. And it was May 1st, 2013, Peter Kovacs. I'm sure you remember that day rather well.
I do remember it. it was a great day, I think, for The Advocate and a great day for Louisiana.
What happened on that day as you look back 5 years ago?
Well, in a technical sense, there was a press conference, as I recall, with the governor at the time, Bobby Jindal, and the two mayors of the city. And you know, John said he was committed to traditional journalistic values and traditional journalism, both in print and digital. And since then, we've succeeded. We've grown the business. We've grown our footprint in New Orleans, particularly. And we've become the largest newspaper in New Orleans, surpassing the Picayune, which would have been unthinkable, you know, 10 years ago or even before 2012.
Is the natural evolution to someday have New Orleans as the centerpiece of the newspaper?
I think what we're committed to is to have a separate newspaper for New Orleans and for Baton Rouge. You know, the printing is done in Baton Rouge, and there is no printing press for a newspaper in New Orleans at this point. The printing press that was owned by the Picayune, which would have needed a capital improvement, was torn down, and that building is fixing to be torn down and converted into an air-conditioned driving range.
You work in Baton Rouge. Do you see that as the place where you'll be for the immediate future?
Yes, I do. I go to New Orleans a couple of days a week. I can get there in an hour and 15 minutes. It's not a bad drive. I've burned a lot of gasoline going back and forth between here and New Orleans.
Well, on this day 5 years ago, the Advocate switched hands, and the Manship family owned the newspapers here in Baton Rouge for over a century. And it was a long courtship that ended with John Georges acquiring the paper. And I'm sure you'll have some sort of recognition of this at the office today. What's happening there?
I believe we're going to have the Dat Dog truck, which I think, as you know, is owned by John's brother. And so I think everyone's going to get free hot dogs in Baton Rouge today and in New Orleans tomorrow.
Well, as I look back over the stories of 5 years ago, it says Georges will meet with the newspaper's 450 employees. That was 2013. How many employees does the Advocate have now?
I would say probably in the 300s. I mean, most newspapers are smaller.
Sure.
Are smaller than they used to be. The staffs are smaller than they used to be. The impact on us has been less harsh than it has on other entities.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that other entities have been cut substantially more, which some say has affected the quality of journalism. Is that a fair observation?
First of all, journalists are only a fraction of the staff of a newspaper, you know, sometimes a quarter to a third. Mm-hmm. So, but less journalists on the ground affects the quality and amount of journalism. But, you know, at the same time, the practice of journalism, when I was young, there were many, many more people in newsrooms, but also the gathering of news was much less efficient. I always tell people, when I was young, if you forgot to ask a question in an interview, you would have to call someone up and sit around waiting on someone to call you back. You know, now you can just text someone. And all those things, you can look at court records without going to the courthouse. You can watch hearings online. Mm-hmm. All those things make journalism more efficient.
I saw Ari Fleischer a few weeks ago at the Manship School, and he said when he was press secretary for President Bush, the second President Bush, he loved it when he got a text because that way he could basically control the flow of information. He had time to think about what he would write, and then he had time to edit what he presented, where when you're talking to somebody, you don't have that luxury.
Well, I would assume if you're a professional press secretary of the president, you're pretty measured in how you talk to people, and you're used to thinking through what you want to say. But I see his point.
Yeah. Well, now we live in a wild universe with President Trump. Has Trump been good for business for newspapers, by and large, in our country?
Well, he's definitely been good for cable TV. I know that because he's entertaining. He's actually done something that's very bad for the newspaper industry, which is to increase tariffs on newsprint. And that has really had a negative effect on newspapers. And you've seen some really substantial layoffs in Denver and in Florida off of just the increased cost of newsprint. And, you know, you don't think about it, but newsprint is probably second to mm-hmm. personnel in the costs of operating a newspaper.
Will that affect the Advocate?
It's affecting us. The size of the newspaper to some degree is determined. It's different on different days. It's determined by ad content. It's determined by news. But it has pinched us. I don't know if people know this particularly in Baton Rouge, but the Picayune went to a smaller page size in response to this, so that their page is narrower than our page, which means each page has a little bit less news.
And if you look like at the World War II museums, those newspapers that are on display, the newspapers in those days were much larger than they are now.
Yeah, the page sizes were very big. In fact, I think kind of inconveniently big in terms of being able to sort of spread
them
out.
Around, yeah.
Yeah, carry them around, spread it out on the breakfast table, or just hold it in the air. So I think most people are comfortable with the size of size of newspapers today.
There are some who believe that a decade from now, maybe two decades from now, there'll be four or five national newspapers that are dailies, and the printed version of papers like The Advocate will be a memory. Is that the way you see it, or do you see there's some staying power for newspapers like yours?
Well, the question you've been asking people have been asking. People asked that question 10 years ago in reference to 2018 and 20 years ago in 1998. And so far, people like receiving a printed newspaper, on their lawn in the morning, hopefully dry. And and I still think there's a market for it. Every company that is in the, newspapers nowadays, companies like ours, and this is true of our rivals too, they have a digital audience. They have digital ad revenue. Most newspapers, have a system of charging for content on their website, which is not something we do at this point. So newspaper companies are more media companies, but the real truth is that still most of the revenue comes from delivering the newspaper and charging subscribers for it and the advertising in it.
Right. That's something that I think people probably don't appreciate, is that despite all these changes, the biggest source of revenue remains the printed version.
And that's true.
Everywhere.
That is true everywhere. And if you look at the publicly traded, we're a privately held company, but if you look at the publicly traded companies, which have to reveal where their money comes from, that's just uniformly true.
Well, at LSU, for example, the daily reveille went from 4 days to one day and is losing more money in one day than it did in four, because same kind of phenomenon.
It's been, I think there were 5 days, actually.
Actually, there were five.
Yeah, that's been a disaster for LSU, for student media at LSU. You know, we have not been shy in stating our disappointment in what's happened at the Manship School, which now has a new dean, and hopefully we will see radical change.
Well, I think Jerry Seppos did a fine job, and this is something that was, of course, endorsed by some members of the faculty beyond the dean, and it happened, but to this point it has not worked out well, and it is the daily reveille. It is hard to say that with a straight face when it's only printing like 38 times a year.
It still says the daily reveille on top of it, and it... You know, it shouldn't, and I don't know if you followed this, but they have, you know, they're in the middle of a dust-up with the student government over the funding for the thing, and I think that is occurring, frankly, because they have diminished the footprint of student media so much so that, you know, members of the student government don't feel like they rely on it. Members, their friends don't feel like they rely on it, and... You know, putting a daily newspaper out there around campus was, you know, people would pick it up and look at it. You had a unique space. You know, now you're one of a million websites, and you had a unique space as a daily printed product.
It is interesting that previous Student Government Association backed an $85 million recreation center, which students are still paying for, and the student newspaper, which of course is far less, is having difficulty. We'll return after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Kabashaw is producing. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. Peter Kovacs is with us, the editor of The Advocate, which 5 years ago today, May 1, 2013, began its reign under new ownership. John Georges, the businessman who's run for office a few times, he bought the paper, and he has invested a lot of his personal stake in this. There's a new facility on Rieger Road, and when other newspapers across the country are closing or contracting to fewer days, The Advocate still is a seven-day-a-week proposition. Do you think that if somebody else had purchased it, let's say if Gannett had purchased it, would we be in a different world than we are now?
Oh, I mean, I think if you look at what they've done with the other newspapers in Louisiana, I think it would be a much smaller staff and a much smaller product. It wouldn't be a four-section newspaper as it is now.
877-217-5757. And to show you how newspapers can make a difference, U.S. Senator John Kennedy, I'm looking over the last 2 days, he sent out a press release calling for Secretary Tom Shedler to resign yesterday. This was a story that emanated in The Advocate about Tom Shedler's emails. And Kennedy quotes The Advocate in his request for Mr. Shedler to leave office. And the day before, he urged the Louisiana legislature to suspend consideration of Harris contract extension. Actually, that was yesterday as well. And it starts by saying, in light of new information reported in The Advocate, the legislature needs to put the contract extension on pause. Here's a guy who's a U.S. senator who obviously is taking a lot of his cues from The Advocate.
If we don't have, I tell people this all the time, you know, if we don't have traditional journalism, investigative journalism, and shoe leather journalism in Louisiana, you know, big, powerful interests will have their way. And, you know, Harris is a good company. It's a good employer. After those bankruptcies, you know, it renegotiated its deal, and it has, you know, it has been a good force in New Orleans. And the truth is that they might, if they were to get the thing rebid, they might win it. But the idea that we are not going to even wonder what that renewal is worth is startling.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Peter Kovacs, editor of The Advocate. Welcome to Talk Louisiana. Hi, Phil. Sashika, can we get Phil potted up here? Sashika, we need Phil.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. First of all, it took a little while to get used to the new format when you took the paper over. When it became local news on the front news, on the front page now, and then the World News on into the paper. And I think that was a good idea because the local news is what you guys are covering. You're doing that well. I want to see the News on Wheels classic things come back, and promise us, please, you will not sell the paper to Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I don't own the paper, so I can't promise you that. But I don't think John intends to sell the paper. I think he enjoys owning the paper. I appreciate your comment about local news. We, you know, our franchise is local news. Increasingly, when it comes to national news, increasingly, you know, people already knew that from the day before. And so we're very committed to local news, you know, to covering Louisiana. And we intend to stay the course.
Thank you, Phil. 877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org for editor Peter Kovacs of the Advocate. Fabio in Grand Coteau. Hi, Fabio. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Mr. Novak. And congratulations Kovacs. On the fifth Kovacs, excuse me. Congratulations on the fifth year of new ownership. I've been reading the Advocate. I mean, in fact, I grew up reading the Advocate, learned how to read partly with the Advocate in the State Times when I was in Baton Rouge. Now I'm in Grand Coteau. And I know that it's a difficult task to have to cover two cities, but you're also in Lafayette. And believe me, Lafayette needs the Acadiana Advocate now more than ever. The alternative weekly here, the Independent, is no longer being published. And the only source is the Gannett newspaper that is less than adequate as far as local news coverage. I was wondering how difficult it is to cover three different locations with radically different agendas or radically different problems facing them. And
all right. Thank you, Fabio.
Well, you know, Lafayette, we published the Acadiana Advocate. We started that 4.5 years ago, and really, unfortunately, the timing wasn't very good because we really ran into the headwind of the downturn in the Lafayette economy. But, you know, we're committed. We have a couple of people in, you know, working in an office. We're on Johnston Street, and we produce in addition for Acadiana every day. There's less news coverage of Acadiana because, frankly, the amount of journalism a community gets sort of depends on the amount of support you get from the community.
Thank you, Fabio. 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on the air with Peter Kovacs, editor of The Advocate.
Good morning, gentlemen. What is The Advocate? I generally read NOLA.com. Has The Advocate taken a strong stand on the environment? Bob Marshall has an excellent column, again, at NOLA.com regarding how the Republican legislature, the Republican delegation in Washington, they want billions of dollars for coastal restoration, but they won't recognize climate change. Within 50 to 80 years, every dime spent on coastal restoration will literally be washed into the Gulf of Mexico.
All right. What about environmental issues?
Well, you know, Louisiana is maybe the most vulnerable state in the country, and we've covered all of that vulnerability. I admire Bob Marshall.
You worked with him for many years.
Yeah, I worked with him at the Picayune. He left the Picayune, I think, when I left the Picayune, and did great work for the Lens. I thought the stuff he did for the Lens was just terrific, and we used some of it. Mm-hmm. And he decided to go back to the Picayune under a deal. And I think he probably—I don't think he writes, but maybe 10 columns a year for him.
He wrote a very good column Sunday, and you have a staple of columnists, and many have followed you from New Orleans. Stephanie Grace, James Gill, Walt Handelsman, the editorial cartoonist, the Pulitzer Prize winner. They are examples. Tyler Bridges is writing for The Advocate fairly regularly now. How active were you in bringing them along with you?
You know, it was, I always say that when we started The Advocate in New Orleans, it was kind of like having 8 of the first 10 draft choices because people really were excited about the mission and they wanted to work for, you know, they wanted to work for a daily, serious adult newspaper. It was a leap of faith at the time because no one had really, in the history of the industry, I don't think anybody had really ever achieved, you know, launching a newspaper in an adjacent market and coming to dominate that market. And I think that's the path we're on.
James Gill, he was a fixture with the Picayune, an exceptionally good rider who hasn't lost much over the years, acerbic at times. Mm-hmm. Are there any columnists who you get to more reaction to, pro and con, than others?
Well, we've introduced a couple of conservative columnists, and there were, and we did that in response to readers saying they wanted a little more balance on, you know, on local things, and we've gotten some compliments on that. James and Stephanie, you know, have always had a following. Lanny Keller is very capable and has a following, and I don't know whether people would say he's liberal or conservative. And Ed Pratt, you know, has a following. So, you know, our aim is to have a variety of columnists across the political spectrum.
Well, on the editorials of the newspaper presents, you have an editorial staff, but I would imagine Lanny and Danny Heitman are extremely active in a lot of those editorials.
Yeah, they do that, and we try to have an editorial position that is in line with the interests of Louisiana. People ask if we're liberal or conservative, and I think most of what we comment on are Louisiana issues, and I think we're generally in favor of, you know, serious, honest government and not showmanship.
Do you write some of the editorials?
Once in a while.
877-217-5757. Peter Kovacs is with us for a few more minutes, and he is the editor of The Advocate, which now, I think, without question, is the newspaper of record in Louisiana. We'll return after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Peter Kovacs, the editor of The Advocate. 5 years ago today, the ownership changed. The Manship family relinquished its control to businessman John Georges of New Orleans. And now The Advocate, of course, has a presence that is substantial, not only in Baton Rouge, but in New Orleans and Acadiana. 877-217-5757. Peter Kovacs, editor. Lately, The Advocate's been doing a series of stories on this non-unanimous jury verdicts that often result in people being convicted of felonies that in other states there would be a hung jury. This is an issue that has relevance and it has momentum in the legislature, but why did it take so long for it to become a huge issue in Louisiana as a whole?
Well, you know, we've spent a year working on that in order to mostly gathering the results of every trial held in Louisiana, or as close as we could get to that, over a five-year period. And that, you know, that took a lot longer than I think we thought it would take. For one thing, you know, the trials are spread around the state, but also the record keeping is very weak and different from parish to parish and from courtroom to courtroom.
And also, of late, The Advocate has been on the one-yard line of the Secretary of State, Tom Shedler. Do you think he'll resign?
It does not look to me like he's basically wants to hang around, you know, Bill Clinton style. But he's, you know, he's under pressure to resign, but I don't exactly know what pressure can exert on him to force his hand. He's an independent elected official.
I think one of your columnists, Jeff Sadow, is calling for the legislature to impeach him. So that would be an interesting move.
You know, I think that would be an outcome. I mean, I suppose theoretically, you know, the legislature controls the budget for him, although that's kind of a nuclear way to, you know, to deal with an elected state official.
But it is curious that some of these officials, Republicans who were slamming Secretary Shedler, they were supportive of David Vitter, who, for all intents, committed a crime by patronizing prostitutes. But he lasted a long time after that, and could have been governor of Louisiana if things had gone differently a few years ago.
Well, I don't think politicians have ever been consistent, and if you expected them to be now.
But when they smell blood in the water, it can be really bad, and I have some empathy for Tom Shedler's staff, and for him. He's in a box now where he pretty much can't talk one way or the other, and that's not a comfortable place to be, and he's twisting, literally twisting in the wind. Jim on Highland Road. Jim, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Peter Kovacs.
I would like to thank Mr. Kovacs and Mr. George for keeping Baton Rouge's newspaper, The Advocate, to be the best newspaper in the country for a town this size and many larger, because I've seen so many creators.
All right, Jim, you're fading on us, but I'm sure Peter appreciates the compliment, and whether you like what you read in The Advocate or not, I think it's fair to say that if the Manships had sold it to somebody else, the environment would be much different now.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I'm sorry we could barely hear you. I think you were in the wind when you were speaking, but I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, one thing when I started and I was on this show probably the first year I was here, one of the things I heard most when I started was that, you know, the threat of The Advocate being owned by New Orleanian and kind of run by New Orleanians, and that it would lose its emphasis on Baton Rouge. And we've worked very hard, you know, not to let that happen. You know, I live in Baton Rouge, and I think, you know, I guess everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but I don't hear that as much as I did the first year.
An email from Holly in the Garden District commending you for retaining one Smiley Gray Anders. Smiley's gained a new audience in New Orleans.
You know, Smiley has a following in New Orleans. One of the first things that happened when I found out I was going to be editor of The Advocate was one of our dear friends was very excited and said, "Do you think you could get Smiley to come talk at our church?" And since I was the new editor, naturally he agreed to do it. And, you know, Smiley's going great guns. He has, I don't know if people realize this, but he has modernized himself, and he tweets haikus. And if you're into Twitter, you should follow him on Twitter. His haikus are, you know, are terrific. There was a time when he was actually putting them at the end of his column, which I liked the idea of, but he said people got tired of them, so we quit doing it.
He is an institution and usually comes on the show a few times a year on his birthday, November 20th, and on June 4th, it'll be 39 years for Smiley at The Advocate. That's next month. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on the air with Peter Kovacs. Ray, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call, and appreciate the show today, especially enjoyed hearing from Mr. Kovacs. I'm a regular follower of The Advocate, and especially of the editorial, so I appreciate that. One thing I do like the most is I think that the editorials make a good point that we have to have a balanced budget. In Louisiana, we have to settle the political aspects and probably raise taxes, which people don't like hearing. But I think that's an important thing, and I'm glad to see the editorials taking a fairly progressive outlook. I'd like to do without a couple of columnists like Jeff Sado and Dan Fagan, but that's...
All right. Okay.
Well, thanks for the kind words. You know, what's happened to the Louisiana budget is really, you know, heartbreaking, because when I was young, you know, Louisiana limped along with renewals of temporary taxes, and that lasted for years. And we finally put ourselves on a plateau where we had a sound budget and a fair tax structure. And after Katrina, under both Blanco and Jindal, people think it was all Jindal, but Blanco also was involved in that. We've kind of undone that, and now we're back where we were in the 80s, you know, with, you know, renewals of temporary sales taxes. And my guess is that's how this drama is going to end, too. They're going to renew some temporary sales taxes and, you know, kick the can down the road until after the next election. Mm-hmm. And the next election never solves it.
Now, I remember when President Trump was elected, he had the gumption to go meet with the New York Times, sat down with all their major writers, and I doubt that he'll do it again, but he did it. And how often does Governor Edwards have an editorial meeting with The Advocate?
He's been very open. His administration has been very open. We have much more contact with him than we did with Jindal. I would say once or twice a year, but more, you know, more critically, you know, regular contact and responsiveness to reporters' questions. You know, an administration that if you ask them something, they get back to you. They may not tell you, they may not choose to get involved in it, but they do get back to you, and we've appreciated that.
Question from Tracy at the Capitol asking your thoughts about the correspondence dinner that has gained a lot of criticism over the last few days.
I don't, you know, I find it a little bit hard to understand why that thing still goes on. I think it's a vestige of another generation, and it's you know, in the era when everyone records everything with their cell phone, I think it's just going to be hard for them to maintain it. And I think the New York Times cut out of it maybe a decade ago, and my suspicion is that others will start cutting out of it. It'll be difficult to keep it going.
Well, when a comic is the headliner, I think you're asking for trouble, and a lot of these journalists were shocked, just shocked. But we've had people on the edge at those events before criticizing presidents from both parties.
Yeah, comedy is tough in those kinds of events. And, you know, once they hire a comedian, you know, unless they insist on editing and vetting the material, you know, they're going to get what they get.
Well, we started by talking about The Advocate and the transition 5 years ago, and it remains a 7-day-a-week printed newspaper. And before The Advocate made its change in ownership, the Picayune shocked the world, going to 3 days a week, and you were there. Was it a shock to you?
It was a shock to me, although the family that owned the Newhouse family had done that in Michigan, so it was always kind of in the background that they might do it. You know, I thought it was a bad idea then. I think it's a bad idea now. If you look at Gannett, which is a successful publicly traded newspaper company, you know, they went to 3 days a week in Detroit in 2009, and, you know, they never did it again. And they recently went to 3 days a week in Alexandria. Last year they went to 3 days a week in Alexandria and one of their markets in Mississippi, and again people looked at it and said, oh, well, if this is what they're going to do, they're going to go to 3 days a week among their 100 newspapers, and they didn't. And I think the reason is it's just not a business model.
You mentioned that The Advocate now has more subscribers in New Orleans than the Picayune. Is that accurate?
We have more subscribers than the Picayune, period.
Well, yeah, but
we have I don't know if we have more subscribers in New Orleans than they do.
Between the two cities, three cities.
We became the biggest newspaper in Louisiana in the fourth quarter of 2014, and it's hard to tell how many subscribers they have. The Picayune does a lot of free throwing of their newspaper, so it's a little hard to count.
But on a Sunday, how many subscribers do you ballpark have right now?
About 90,000.
90,000.
Yeah.
Which, by today's standards, is a good number.
By today's standards. Yeah, that's pretty good.
But in its heyday, the Picayune, when you were there, probably had hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, probably 250,000 to 300,000.
That shows how it's changed. But 90,000, and it remains, as you have stated, the most lucrative part of the operation, the printed version, and that. Despite all this attention about the shiny new object, it remains the case that the printed version is the one that carries the freight for the rest of the machine.
Yeah, it has subscription revenue, and also advertisers. You know, it's an elite environment, and so advertisers, you know, want to be in an elite environment.
Well, we thank you for joining us, taking all comers. Peter Kovacs, editor of The Advocate. Let's do it again soon.
Okay.
Always
a
pleasure.
On the sixth anniversary.
On the sixth anniversary. And we didn't even get around to fake news today, so we'll save that for our next visit with Peter Kovacs. We'll be back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Sasha Baushaw is producing, and we switch gears, and Elizabeth Partridge is with us, a National Book Award finalist, the author of several nonfiction books, and her latest is Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam. And good morning to you, Elizabeth Partridge.
Good morning.
I think you're joining us from San Francisco, so I know it's early, but this is a topic that has relevance all these years later. 58,000 Americans died in the Vietnam War. It seared our country, and people are still debating the merits of the war and debating the validity of U.S. presidents who did not serve in the war. And we've had three of the Vietnam generation who opted out in one way or another, and Bill Clinton, George Bush, and Donald Trump. All these years later, are you surprised at the continuing discussion about Vietnam and its impact on our country?
Not in the least. By researching this book, I only understood much more deeply how complicated those times were and how we left a lot of cards on the table. You know, there was a lot we didn't resolve. And so there's a lot of lessons still to be learned by paying attention to the kinds of choices we made as a country and that people made as individuals.
You quote Lyndon Johnson early on as saying, "We're not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves."
That, you know, President Johnson was extremely conflicted about the war. You know, he had this strong need to fight communism, which was reinforced by Congress and by American. It was, you know, it was in the water at the time. There was this terrible fear of communism. So he felt he needed to fight communism. On the other hand, he really didn't want to send Americans into combat. So he was actually quite agonized every time he stepped further and further in. But I will say, by the end of 1967, he had committed nearly 500,000 troops in Vietnam. So he did step in.
The book is Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam, with Elizabeth Partridge, and she is with us. And as we know, the war had pushback, and it started during the Johnson years in a big way with protests all over the country. Ultimately, the 36th American president opted not to seek another term in office. At the time, how significant were the protests on the culture at large?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I bet you would get a bunch of different answers if you asked a bunch of different people. They certainly were causing a tremendous awareness among President Johnson and other policymakers that there was a growing groundswell that was just, it was a drumbeat getting louder and louder and louder that they could not ignore. I think it had a tremendous impact. Other people say, no, these were just kids out on the streets protesting. These were the wealthier kids. These were the kids who didn't have to serve. But gradually, of course, it did begin to include Americans from all walks of life.
You quote Lyndon B. Johnson as saying, "The blow to morale was more of our own doing than anything the enemy had accomplished with its army. We were defeating ourselves."
Yep, that is how he felt. The thing about President Johnson is he was a fighter. He was a tough, tough guy. And he fought for some things that I feel very strongly about, that he did a great job. You know, the civil rights legislation that he got through early in his presidency was just amazing. But he did not like not having the support of the American people. Of course not. These are the, you know, this is the country that elected him. He wanted people behind him, and he did not have that.
Elizabeth,
in increasing numbers.
There's a great photo in your book. And I think many have probably seen it before, but it captures the Johnson angst over Vietnam when he's listening to an audio tape sent from Vietnam by Captain Charles Robb, his son-in-law, in 1968. It obviously had a great effect on President Johnson, the war did.
Yes, it did. That photograph is heartbreaking, and that really helps to understand how conflicted and pained he was. He did have a son-in-law serving in Vietnam, and he's listening to a tape back in the days of reel-to-reel tape. He's listening to a tape sent from Vietnam by his son-in-law, and President Johnson's head is just literally down on the table. You know, it's just, you know, he was aware of the very high cost that Americans were paying with their lives for what the decisions he was making.
And President Richard M. Nixon, he promised to end the war in 6 months when he ran in 1968. And he's quoted in your book as saying, "I will not be the first president of the United States to lose a war."
That's right. He did run on a platform of getting out. He was pulled in by many, many factors, like many people were, although he did start stepping down the troops, and in 1973, he had to decide whether or not to re-upped the draft, which had, was expiring, and he chose not to. So he did make changes in lowering what was going on in Vietnam, but of course, ultimately, he was pulled out of office by his own bad actions that had nothing, well, very little to do with Vietnam, and a lot to do with his own paranoia.
We're listening to the voice of Elizabeth Partridge, National Book Award finalist. Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam is her latest work. And Daryl on College, you're on the air with Elizabeth. Hi, Daryl.
How you doing? The thing I wanted to mention is that like the Vietnam War, we just had the war in Iraq, which cost considerable amount of money and lives, that those wars turned out that what they fought them for was not actually true. And I was wondering if you could kind of draw or if you see a parallel in things that they start wars for ending up not being true. Is that like a thread between these two wars?
That's definitely a really interesting part of looking back at the Vietnam War. There was an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin under President Johnson early on in his time as president where it possibly is true that there was aggression from the North Vietnamese upon an American ship, but most historians now agree that that didn't happen. And what Johnson did was actually he put in a Gulf of Tonkin Act through Congress, and ended up with quite a bit of power to continue making decisions in Vietnam without Congress moderating or overseeing his behavior. So it's a really interesting part of a democracy that, you know, we have to be able to hold our elected officials accountable. You know, that's something we always have to be vigilant for in a democracy, no matter what year.
You have a featured chapter in the book on a Vietnam nurse, Lily Lee Adams. She's a fascinating person.
Yeah, she's just a wonderful person. I loved interviewing Lily. She went from being a really kind of person who was oriented towards the peace movement. She ended up a nurse in Vietnam and had to deal with these young bodies that were just, you know, blown up or had, you know, gotten gassed by some of the chemicals we were using. So she just had a year of horror, basically, that she had to cope with. And it was very interesting to talk with her about her year there and about how it made a very complex relationship with God for her because she trusted God. She was raised a Catholic. She had a very profound relationship with God. But then she was like, "How, God, how can you let this be happening?" And then when she came back to the United States and began a civilian life again, she had to sort of try to release some of that trauma. But she never has. You know, she still lives with a very quick reaction to any kind of trauma.
Lastly, when I look at some of these amazing photographs in your book, Boots on the Ground, I see a lot of Lyndon Johnson. And he was 6'4", about 2 inches taller than our current president. But they have something in common in the way they used their physical stature. Johnson certainly, he got in the faces of people he was negotiating with.
He did. It was called the Johnson treatment. He would literally loom over people and just get closer and closer to them until they would be like doing a little back bend in order to try to just hold up next to him. Yeah, that was the Johnson treatment, and it was pretty rough, apparently, according to people who had to try to deal with him. It was just imposing.
Well, thank you for your fine book and your visit today, Elizabeth Partridge, Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam. That's it for today. For Sasha Kabashaw, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.